Starting this evening's program, I'd like to just take a few seconds here to make a few introductory comments before calling on our president. With this lecture, this evening the Vancouver Institute is finishing its 85th year of free public education, which started back with the beginning of the university in 1916. Our mandate established then was to provide free public education, lectures in the arts and social sciences and sciences. We'd like to make it to 100 years or more, and we can't do that without your support. As you may know, we're an all-volunteer, nonprofit organization, and the funds that we receive basically go for printing of our program, advertising, and miscellaneous expenses to our speakers, since most of our speakers provide their time free of charge. Without your financial support, quite frankly, the Institute would cease operations. As I said before, you are our only source of funds. So if you haven't done so already, would you please consider signing up as a member or giving a donation to the Institute? Donations are tax deductible. And as a special inducement, if you become a member this evening, you have free membership for the next 20 lectures coming along in the fall and next spring. So we encourage you to give this very serious consideration. At this point, would you please join me in expressing our gratitude to our president this year, Dr. John Diggins, who's done an outstanding job over the last two terms in presiding over these lectures. John, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and thank all of you. It's been a great year, but I have told Peter many times that one thing I've learned over the year that the Vancouver Institute's greatest asset are the people who attend here, and a quality about those people, and that is that ability to ask questions. Because all of the speakers, they know what they're going to say, but they always remark to me after, boy, the questions. These people, so it is a great asset of this institution and something that it's been a pleasure to be part of over the last year. This is the second night in April and the last one of the season, and I wonder if it would be appropriate, as we did at the opening of the year, to thank two people, Peter Nemetz and Roseanne Rumley, who have provided the speakers and the organization for the Vancouver Institute, ladies and gentlemen. Also with us tonight, and co-sponsoring this evening, is the chair of the program in Canadian Studies at the University of British Columbia. Please welcome Professor of English, Richard Cavell. Richard? Our speaker tonight, Cheryl Grace, is an award-winning teacher, researcher, and writer who's had an outstanding academic career and an outstanding impact on the world around her. Dr. Grace received her graduate education in English literature at McGill University, and after teaching at McGill, joined the Department of English at the University of British Columbia and became a full professor in 1987. She served as associate professor of the Dean of Arts, associate Dean of Arts for 3 years and UBC Senator for 9 years, and is currently head of the Department of English. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and a senior fellow at Green College, where I have a great association with her, Cheryl, which is wonderful. She's received, among many awards, the Killam Research Prize and the Jacob Biley Prize. And she's a member of many associations in her sphere of interest and influence, but one that I wanted to highlight tonight is she's the current past president of our association, the Vancouver Institute. And Cheryl, we're very pleased for the contribution you've made and appreciative. Dr. Grace has lectured widely in Canada, United States, as well as around the world. She's published over 150 articles and 11 books, including Staging the North, about Canadian plays. And she'll draw on her new book, Canada and the Idea of North, for her talk tonight, titled Ideas of North. Please welcome Dr. Cheryl Grace.
Thank you very much, John. And a special thank you to all of you who have braved, if not an Arctic night, certainly a rather nasty one, to be here this evening. I appreciate it very much. I'm going to do something a little different before I begin. My talk is about 45 minutes with slides, which it would appear they're going to work. It's the first time I've ever used PowerPoint, so it was something I was nervous about. But I would like to, before I begin, make a dedication of this evening's lecture. It's not a usual thing to do, I know, at the Vancouver Institute, but I would like to do so. This lecture, therefore, is dedicated to Dr. Gabriella Helms. Gabby is not able to be here this evening with us, but Gabby, this is for you. I have a lecture then in four parts. Part one, follow me. In the preface to Canada and the Idea of North, I quote Mary Shelley to introduce the following invitation. Follow me. I seek the everlasting ices of the North, where you will feel the misery of cold and frost, to which I am impassive. Except that the words of Dr. Frankenstein's creature must be revised. At the beginning of the 21st century, it seems that the ices of the North may not be everlasting, and that none of us can afford to be impassive. Therefore, follow me while there still is time. And this is indeed my invitation this evening. Follow me, and I hope you will find many rewards on the journey. For me, this journey has taken many years, well over a decade, and it is far from over. But on tonight's short journey, I will talk about things already done and for which I have enjoyed much help. First, I would like to pay tribute to the fund of knowledge that others have shared with me. And some of those others are my UBC colleagues in history, geography, fine art, anthropology, music, film, and Canadian literature. A few of you are here tonight. Thank you. Second, I want to acknowledge the encouragement and stimulating curiosity of my many students, friends, and especially my family, because these good folks have cheerfully accompanied me on actual journeys north, or listened patiently to my enthusiasm and my theories, or shared their differing views with me in discussion and debate. Some have even helped with the technology, a domain in which I am feeble. Again, thank you. But most importantly, I am grateful for the wealth of painting, music, literature, sculpture, theater, and film that Canadian artists have given me over the last 150 years. Without them, there would be no ideas of North. I owe personal thanks to all those who gave me permission to reproduce images in my book, but tonight I would like to mention just one. Doris Shadbolt, who allowed me to use a excerpt, a piece, from Jack Shadbolt's Bush Pilot in the Northern Sky on the cover of my book. The full piece is in the book, but it's something else to take a piece of a painting and slap words on top of it. Finally, I want to thank Peter for inviting me to speak here in a forum I have long valued, Richard Cavell for co-sponsoring the evening, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research of Council of Canada for the support of my work. I have often been asked how I became interested in the North. This question is usually put to me with mild amusement and puzzlement. It is a version of how did a nice middle-aged female English prof like you end up in a place like that? Well, let me put that question aside right away by replying, why not? Or, where do you think that place is? Or more seriously, that it's a long, personal, and ultimately boring story. The important point is that now that I have gone north, I love the place, I treasure it, and I hope I can persuade you this evening to share something of my passion. North, the North, ideas about North have a great deal to tell us as we live here in the South. And whatever else I may touch upon this evening, I want always to return to my motivating idea, my own true North, which is that a study of culture is a study of ourselves as individuals in society. And I believe we have a responsibility to learn, understand, and appreciate where and who we are. Let me be precise and ask how it is that we can be here tonight in the South, in a room without windows, surrounded by light at 20 after 8 or so, and that, at a flick of a switch, we hope. At a flick of a switch, this can happen. Tonight, I want to try to convince you of at least these 5 points. That North is as much an idea and a present force right here as it is a physical place somewhere else far away. That what Canadians understand is the North has moved over time from its earlier location in the southeast of the country to areas ever further north and west. That there are many Norths, many ideas of North. That these ideas have changed over time and are still changing. And that these changing ideas of North are fundamental to a sense of who we are as a nation. I find all these points inscribed in Don Prosh's powerful mask sculpture. But most important of all is its seductive suggestion that we create and are created by ideas of North. This is one artist's idea of our northern landscape, using key iconographic northern indices of magnetism, rock face, water, and canoe as a human face. Here are just a few, a tiny sampling from the past 65 years of some of these ideas. Stephen Leacock, a major author. Glenn Gould, and that was, by the way, Glenn Gould's voice and voices from the Idea of North that you were hearing as you were waiting for this to start. Glenn Gould, from his introduction to the sound documentary that inspired me and gives me part of my book's title, The Idea of North. R. Murray Schafer, one of our internationally known composers. Louis-Edmond Amelin, one of our greatest geographers. And Susan Cardinal, a Dene woman and broadcaster living in Calgary. I won't take the time to read and review each of these, but I mention them to underline the multiplicity of voices that have influenced my thinking about the Canadian North. There have also been many visual images that have fascinated and influenced me, and maps are among the most powerful. Maps bear eloquent testimony to ideas of North that have circulated for centuries. They teach us how these ideas have changed, and they show us how we shape and are shaped by such images. Here, for example, is Mercator's 1606 map of the Arctic. It's beautiful. It is an intriguing mix, also, of partial fact and pure fiction, with pygmies living near the pole and an imaginary island called Frisland. Here is Canadian writer Rudy Weeb's equally, deliberately fanciful take on part of the North, but from a postmodern 1989 perspective, where he has turned the tables on the South by turning things upside down. And here, in case these perspectives are confusing, are two contemporary Canadian cartographic representations of our physical shape, one showing some of the best-known Nordicity lines, permafrost, and so on, and the other are shifting internal boundaries after the 1st of April, 1999. I want to come back to this one. From the beginning of my conscious research on the North, I have operated on a few basic assumptions. That it is vitally important to ask who we are as a nation, as a country, and as a collectivity of peoples. This is a fundamental question for a humanist, indeed for any one of us to ask. Following from this assumption are my next ones, that Canada matters and that studying it is inherently fascinating, that studying Canada means studying the North, or Norths, which have played such a strategic and symbolic role in defining who we are and where we are. And that if we are going to face, let alone address, such massive problems as global warming, environmental degradation, and species loss, then we must learn as much as we can about the Canadian North and about Canada's position within the much larger circumpolar North. But I am not going to address global warming. What I can do as a humanist who specializes in the study of Canada is to set forth an interdisciplinary approach to the North that helps us in the South grasp the magnitude, complexity, and importance of the North. So although I have just shown you some maps of the Canadian Norths, I am now going to ask you to put such facts aside and let your imagination come with me on a short historical journey through some ideas of North. After the tour, I will return to some contemporary Nordicity indices that show how and why the North matters right now and right here. Part two, some ideas of North. If you were to visit the Hamilton Art Gallery tomorrow, chances are you would be able to see a famous Canadian painting prominently displayed on its walls. Chances are you would have seen the image before in histories of Canadian art, because the painting played an important role in establishing a reputation for Canadian art in France at the end of the 19th century. Whether you had seen the image before in a book or were seeing it in the gallery for the first time, you would almost certainly be fascinated by its quality of chill, ominous mystery. The canvas is not especially large, but its power is not a function of size. In the foreground, a hooded figure with snowshoes strapped to his back kneels in the snow. All around him and receding into distant drifts lies moonlit snow. The sky is dark, but if you look closely, there are a few stars. However, it is not the stars, the night sky, the pale snow, or even the fallen trapper who holds your attention. Ahead of this man, just beyond his outstretched arm and clearly discernible against the snow, is a figure walking away into the picture plane and out of the painting. Who or what is this? Another trapper? A ghost? Or given the resemblance of the fallen trapper to this ghostly presence, is this figure the trapper's doppelganger, his very soul, and thus the image of his death? The painting I've just been describing, and it is up on the slide for you, is Blair Bruce's The Phantom Hunter, recently renamed The Phantom of the Snow. And it was an immense success at the 1888 Paris Salon. Today, it is Bruce's most famous painting, and it enjoys a privileged place in the iconography of Canada's image of itself as a northern nation. Bruce's inspiration for the painting came in part from an 1859 poem by a now unheard-of poet called Charles Shanley, and the poem was called The Walker of the Snow. This is a deceptively simple narrative poem based on legends or folk tales about the Shadow Hunter, a figure who bears some resemblance to the Wendigo of Ojibwe and Cree mythology. The speaker in the poem tells his listener about an encounter he has had, maybe or maybe not survived, with the Shadow Hunter who walks the midnight snow and kills men who pass through the valley alone on cold winter nights. The hunter wears a gray hood and appears suddenly beside you just as you are about to enter the valley. More importantly, he leaves no footmarks on the snow. The climax of the tale comes just as he and his companion are about to enter the valley of the Walker of the Snow. And I'll read you a few lines. Then the fear chill gathered o'er me, like a shroud around me cast, as I sank upon the snowdrift where the Shadow Hunter passed. And the otter trappers found me before the break of day, with my dark hair blanched and whitened as the snow in which I lay. But they spoke not as they raised me, for they knew that in the night I had seen the Shadow Hunter and had withered in his blight. Even today, in a postmodern Canada where we can build towns like Inuvik on the permafrost, take oil from the Beaufort Sea, escape from wind chill and temperatures of minus 30 or worse into the West Edmonton Mall, and transport the Canadian Shield to downtown Toronto, it is difficult to shrug off this little poem. It is difficult because the poem reminds us, just as it did Blair Bruce at the end of the 19th century, that our northern world is a dangerous one. The poem, like the painting it inspired, reminds us forcibly of things we might like to forget, such as the terrible ice storm that crippled Montreal in January of 1998, and you have an image of it here in one of Benoit Aquin's amazing photographs. If you cannot visit the Hamilton Art Gallery or find Shanley's obscure poem, what ideas about the North might you get by watching Robert Flaherty's film, Nanook of the North, or reading Herman Vaughan's plays? Nanook of the North, which is readily available on video, was first released in 1922 and was largely filmed at the Revelon Frères fur trading post at Port Harrison, now Inukshuak in Ungava. The film made Flaherty famous and popularized the image of the Eskimos as childlike, fur-clad, smiling people. In the opening sequence of the film, Canada is equated with the north of Hudson Bay and Ungava, and the Eskimo subjects of the film are constructed as representative of all Inuit. The actors are not identified by name as actors. Instead, we come to know them as Nanook, the bear or the great hunter, and his family. Compared with the norths of Shanley and Bruce, Flaherty's north is livable, and its cheerful inhabitants are quite at home. 8 years after Nanook, the southern Ontario playwright Herman Vaughan published 6 Canadian plays, the volume in which he announced his new northern vision for a Canadian theatre. Vaughan, who was deeply influenced by the Group of Seven, believed that a truly Canadian drama must use Canadian subjects and northern settings. The 6 plays he edited for the volume used these subjects and settings, and Vaughan illustrated the book with production photographs, drawings of northern scenes by Lowry Warner, and paintings by members of the Group of Seven. Vaughan's introduction was, in fact, a manifesto linking Canadian nationalism, Nordicity, and the arts. For his own plays, such as Northern Storm, Northern Song, and this one, Rocks, from 1932, Vaughan used silver-gray-blue lighting on the simplest abstract sets to evoke a northern atmosphere that would make the North, as he put it, a participant in the action, an unseen actor. But no consideration of the Canadian North is complete without the Hjalmar Stefansson, arguably Canada's greatest Arctic explorer. Stefansson organized 3 expeditions to the Arctic and wrote several important and very popular books about his explorations, about the Inuit, and about Arctic history and legend. He was an explorer, an anthropologist, an ardent advocate of the North, and an extremely interesting writer who argued for the friendliness of the Arctic and attempted to dispel a series of what he believed were ill-founded prejudices, errors of fact, and negative assumptions about the North. In his 1921 book, The Friendly Arctic, he sets out to convince his readers that the North is a friendly place, rich in resources and high in potential for development and settlement. It is the mental attitude of the Southerner, Stefansson insists, that makes the North hostile. It is chiefly our unwillingness to change our minds which prevents the North from changing into a country to be used and lived in, just like the rest of the world. One by one, Stefansson tackles the sins committed by non-Northerners against the North. First to go is the idea of eternal ice, and here I remember Dr. Frankenstein's creature, which will not hold up before the facts of precipitation and glacier formation. Next to go are the notions of that the North is always covered in snow and that it suffers an everlasting winter of intense cold. Montreal, as Stefansson points out, and remember Benoit Aquin's photograph, receives more snow than many parts of the Arctic, and summer temperatures in the western subarctic and Arctic can go as high as 90 degrees Fahrenheit. People, Stefansson exclaims, are willing to believe any horror of the North if it centers around cold and ice. Then he rejects the term barren ground as libelous, that's his word, and he lists the flowers and abundant wildlife that actually do exist across this not-so-lifeless tundra, filling it, for very brief periods, I must add, with color and sound. This is Pointetilia in full bloom at Bathurst Inlet. In his introduction to the friendly Arctic, Robert Borden, then Prime Minister of Canada, gave Stephenson a ringing endorsement. He praised the expedition for adding many thousands of square miles to the country, for increasing scientific knowledge, and for dispelling many illusions with respect to Arctic conditions, illusions that would impede development. But Borden was not the first Canadian politician with an interest in the North, and he would not be the last. 25 years later, in an article called Canada Looks Down North, Lester Pearson announced that Go North has replaced Go West as the call to adventure. And he went on to outline the seriousness with which Canada viewed, and I quote, the responsibilities and the opportunities that attach to our ownership of this vast area. 1946 was a strategic moment in which to publish what I am tempted to call this mission statement. It was an occasion to remind the world of Canada's Arctic sovereignty, something the Americans would question in the wake of their World War II activities in Canada's north. We need only recall the creation of Frobisher Bay as an American military base, the Dew Line, and the international contretemps later provoked by American ships in Canadian Arctic waters. I'm thinking of the Manhattan in 1969 and the Polar Sea in 1985. Or, right this moment, in the Guardian Weekly for March 14, 2002, and a colleague brought this to my attention, under the title, Melting Ice Will Open Arctic Trade Route, an American naval commander claims that the Northwest Passage is international and must be secured by the United States against terrorism. In the mid-40s, Pearson wished to stress the potential for and significance of northern development. A whole new region, Pearson exclaimed, has been brought out of the blurred and shadowy realm of northern folklore and shown to be an important and accessible part of our modern world. He went on to itemize the great wealth in the land of the midnight sun in gold and precious pitch blend. And he hinted that the snowy wastes of the Canadian North have many more mineral secrets of that kind to yield. If Pearson did not fully accept Stephenson's vision of a friendly Arctic waiting for development, he nonetheless moved an idea of North further up the Canadian political agenda. It was the Conservatives, under Diefenbaker, who transformed a northern vision into a successful election platform. On 12 February 1958, in Winnipeg, during his now famous, or infamous, depending on how you look at it, campaign opening speech, Diefenbaker proclaimed, "We are fulfilling the vision and the dream of Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. But Macdonald saw Canada from east to west. I see a new Canada, a Canada of the North." Whatever else can be said about Diefenbaker's northern vision, and much has, the Canadian public responded by returning the Conservatives to power with a stunning 208-seat majority. But let me return to the painters. Loren Harris always insisted that his work was founded on a long and growing love and understanding of the North, of being, as he said, permeated with its spirit. And over his career, his north expanded to include areas far north and far west of Algoma and Lake Superior. More than any other member of the group, Harris wrote about the north in comments that have been published, printed, quoted, and reprinted until it has become a critical commonplace to associate him with the mystic north, the replenishing north, the spiritual clarity and flow of the North, and with a national ideal of northernness. Of all the Harris paintings I might have chosen to contemplate here this evening, Winter Comes from the Arctic to the Temperate Zone captures succinctly many of the ideas of North that have been circulating thus far in my examples. The first striking aspect of this canvas is the limited palette the pure, shimmering blue mountain or glacier-like shape rising in the background is balanced but not displaced by the creamy white snow-clad shapes of tree and shoreline in the foreground. These two massive vertical forms mirror each other across the smaller, horizontal, deeper blue shape of an island. On the dominant vertical axis of the painting, the eye moves from the distinct cold blue tips of mountain or glacier down to the treetop and down again to the frozen shapes in the foreground until, at the very bottom of the picture, the eye rests on spots of yellow, the only warm touches in the entire composition. From there, the gaze is drawn back up the painting and off the top of the canvas towards an imagined pole. What Harris has done in Winter Comes from the Arctic to the Temperate Zone is to connect the temperate zone of boreal forest with the barren, ice-surrounded subarctic and the high Arctic of glaciers. He has linked the more southerly north of Shanley and Bruce with the far north of Stephenson. By joining them visually, by imaging their symmetry and mirroring duplication, he creates an allegory of Canada as north, moreover, of a multiple Canada as unified in and by north. For Canadians like Vodin and Harris, the north was indeed God's country. However, the idea of God's country had much more popular roots, which have spread deeply in the fertile commercial ground of popular culture over the last 100 or so years. Putting aside the movies explicitly using this term, such as Neil Shipman's Back to God's Country, 1919, I want to consider a popular image that is inextricably bound up with ideas of North that I hope, that I guess, many of you will remember from childhood. Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. In the first half of the 20th century, images of the Mounties proliferated through radio serials or movies about Canada. Pierre Burton claims that of the 575 Hollywood movies made about Canada between 1905 and 1956, the overwhelming majority represents the country as vaguely northern or Arctic, and 256 feature the Mounties. Of these movies, Rosemarie was the most popular, and the 1935 sound version starring Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy is famous. This is the one with, you know, I am calling you. Yes, that one. While Sergeant Preston owes much to the earlier Canadian Mountie radio serial Men in Scarlet and to movies, this northern hero probably reached more Canadians than any of his predecessors because he was aired serially on CBC Radio during the late 40s and early 50s, and he starred in 78 episodes on CBC Television between 1955 and 1978. Videos of the hugely popular television series are easily available today. The stories are fairly predictable. They are set in the Yukon, usually in or around Dawson City, at the height of the Klondike Gold Rush, which is 1896 to 98. And wicked machinations occur in such immoral spots as the Gold Nugget Saloon. The incorruptible Preston, almost always in dress uniform, always gets his man, despite fierce blizzards, numbing cold, and the dramatic sound effects of blowing wind, barking dogs, and cries of mush. The 40s and 50s were, in fact, rich in popular images of the Canadian North. One might say that the younger generation of voters who would bring Diefenbaker his majority in 1958 were brought up on the Men in Scarlet and Sergeant Preston and such explicitly northern comic book heroes as Dixon of the Mounted, Fleur de Lis, and my favorite, Nelvana of the Northern Lights, a.k.a. Alana North, secret agent. Nelvana, the brainchild of Adrian Dingle and Franz Johnson, was a white goddess figure, daughter of the King of the Northern Lights and very loosely based on Inuit mythology. She was made more up-to-date with long hair and miniskirts. She could travel at the speed of light on the Aurora Borealis, make herself invisible, transform others, and control communication. It is tempting to imagine Glenn Gould, who was born in 1932, listening to Men in Scarlet and Sergeant Preston on the radio, or reading Dixon of the Mountain and Nelvana of the Northern Lights. He was, after all, an inveterate radio listener and quite comfortable with popular culture. It is tempting, but I have no evidence for it. Gould claimed that his inspiration for the idea of North came from school maps of the Northwest Territories, reproductions of Group of Seven paintings on schoolroom walls, aerial photographs, and geological surveys. This unusual composition was commissioned as a centennial project for CBC Ideas and was first broadcast on the 28th of December, 1967. 3 months later, it aired on CBC's Northern Service Tuesday night. Gould's introductions for the two broadcasts differ in interesting ways and demonstrate his awareness of the gap between Southern and Northern Canadian perceptions of the North. In 1970, he adapted it, adding visuals and actors to the score and music to create the CBC television version of the work. In his 1993 feature film, 32 short films about Glenn Gould, François Girard uses the idea of North as his governing metaphor for Gould himself. In this image, you have him standing by the Muskeg Express, which he actually did take as far as Churchill in order to do the research for the idea of North. But just as Gould's idea of North has had several incarnations, which by the 1990s had recuperated Gould himself, making him over as or into North, so the composition itself does not inscribe a fixed, single idea of North. Gould's North is, in fact, contrapuntal and multiple. The idea of North presents the interaction of the voices of five characters, and you heard some of that as you were waiting for us to start tonight. Those voices were playing somewhere in the building. The interaction of the voices of five characters who were carefully chosen by Gould to represent five different responses to the North. They include an enthusiast, a cynic, a government budget watcher, and someone who represents the limitless expectation and limitless capacity for disillusionment, Gould's words, a position filled by an anthropologist and geographer. Inevitably, each character turns to the question of the relationship of the North to the rest of Canada, to the idea of nation, and to the way the North shapes the Southern individual who goes there. These reflections flow smoothly into observations about some of the harsh realities of the North: poverty, alcoholism, starvation, racism, sexism. And so the polylogue continues, swaying back and forth like the train from one voice to another, from romance and myth to harsh realities, from dreams of El Dorado or utopia to the challenges of the future. An extremely important theme introduced late in the composition concerns the future of the North, which one man sees as just like the rest of Canada. Another sees as full of dramatic developments like drilling for oil in the Beaufort Sea, while another sees the North becoming a place for creation, recreation, recreation, the place to go for universals and knowledge on a global scale. Just audible, underneath these voices, is what Gould called the basso continuo of the train, carrying us all further and further north. Part 3, From Gould to Atanarjuat. Since the 1967 premiere of Gould's The Idea of North, the North and ideas about it have continued to circulate within our culture. They have also continued to change and multiply. Between 1967 and today, the North has become more important to the entire country and a more significant, albeit problematic and challenging, subject. Although my Nordicity indices are not as scientific as Amelin's, I have my own ways of calculating what I see as the increasing profile of the North over the past 35 years, and I would now like to touch upon a few. The rising importance of the North is demonstrated by the sheer quantity of published work on or about the North. This work ranges from scientific papers and scholarly monographs in history, geography, art history, and so forth, to popular books, often lavishly illustrated, children's books, serious fiction, biography, and yes, autobiography. I think everyone who goes north feels they must write about it. A number of particular events over the past 30 years has kept the North, be it provincial, subarctic, or high Arctic, in the public eye. That is, in the newspapers, on radio and television, and in NFB documentaries, a high percentage of which focus on the North. I want to mention just four. First, the obsessive interest shown in the fate of the 1845 Franklin expedition. From the government-sponsored Centennial Project Franklin, to forensic anthropologist Owen Beatty's sensational research on Beachy Island graves in the 1980s. And this is one of Owen's photographs. They opened up this grave, and the young sailor, of course, preserved all that time in the permafrost. The results of this research were published in a very popular book called Frozen in Time, Unlocking the Secrets of the Franklin Expedition, and led to ongoing scientific debate about the role of lead poisoning in the disaster, and to fresh attempts to find the lost ships, Terror and Erebus. Every summer, it seems, some team arrives on King William Island to search for clues, looking, as Stan Rogers puts it in his famous song, The Northwest Passage, the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. But if Franklin is a key index of current interest in the North, there are many others. Take, for example, the tragic consequences of the controversial relocations in 1953 and 1955 of Inuit from their traditional homes in northern Quebec to the high Arctic. These relocations sparked heated debate in the aftermath of the 1991 Soberman Report. Still more recent, as I know you'll recall from your television screens, is the plight of the Innu in Labrador. Or take the example of the Mackenzie Pipeline inquiry and the attention focused on northern issues by Thomas Berger's 1977 report. If you are following the news today, you will know that attention is once more focused on building a pipeline. Or on the other side of the country, remember the protests leading up to the 1975 James Bay Agreement and subsequently the Le Grand and Agreet Whale hydroelectric projects? Events surrounding the latter phase of the development brought Canada and Quebec to world attention when the Northern Cree of Nunavik took their protest to an international stage in the early 90s. This photograph by Chase Rowe shows them demonstrating in the New York City harbor. But the question of James Bay has not gone away. On the 7th of February, 2002, Quebec Premier Bernard Landry signed a new agreement called La Paix des Braves with Grand Chief of the Grand Council of the Cree, Ted Moses. This agreement clears the way for further hydroelectric development on the East Main and Rupert Rivers, in return for which the Cree will receive about $3.5 billion over the next 50 years, but will abandon about $3.6 billion in environmental lawsuits against the province stemming from the 70s. According to La Presse, about 220 square kilometers, roughly 10 miles square, the size of what? Point Grey in Kitsilano, will be destroyed. Former Grand Chief Billy Diamond described the deal as a shock and a radical change of doctrine. And Cree protester Henry Diamond was arrested for his opposition to the signing. But roughly 70% of the James Bay Cree are reported to have voted in favor of the deal. If I raise this issue tonight, it is certainly not to condemn or to celebrate it. I simply do not know enough to do either. I raise it to remind us of our profound reliance here in the South on northern resources. To underline our indebtedness, we can have light down here because of our own immense hydroelectric resources in our own provincial north, think of Bennett Dam, and to stress our responsibility to return the benefits to northerners. I also raise it to insist that deals like this one are actively modifying both the physical north and our ideas of north, in this case by writing concepts of Aboriginal rights home, and mutual North-South benefit into our history. But perhaps the most significant Nordicity index is Nunavut. As you know, on the 1st of April 1999, the map of Canada changed with the creation of Nunavut, and a new premier, Paul Ogilek, joined the constitutional table. Canada made history in many ways on that day, but one of the most significant of these was our recognition and legitimation of a new idea of North as a northern homeland, lived in and governed by Inuktitut-speaking Canadians. Of course, none of it did not happen overnight, and its creation marks both a new beginning and a readdressing of old challenges. Moreover, Nunavut is part of a larger phenomenon that includes the Northern Encounters Arts Festival, the 1994 appointment of Mary Simons as Canada's first Arctic ambassador, NSERC's recently renewed support with SHRC of Arctic research, and just last month, the 17th annual Arctic Winter Games. But if there was ever a need for Southern Canadians to better understand the North, our North too, as Amelin reminds us, the creation of Nunavut highlights that need. I say this because my survey of the newspapers in the months leading up to and following the 1st of April 1999 indicated that the coverage was overwhelmingly biased against our newest territory. Journalists repeatedly stressed statistics on suicide, unemployment, substance abuse, and they warned about an increased drain on the public, read Southern, purse to support Nunavut. Nowhere did I see any mention, let alone analysis, of what the North has meant and provided for Canadians, from the fur trade to the tar sands, from oil to hydroelectricity. And how do you measure the value of tourism, popular culture, great art, history, living language, heritage? But mysteries, scientific puzzles, natural resources, and political confrontations are by no means the only indices available for assessing the rising significance of the North on the Canadian scene. The retrospective exhibition celebrating the Group of Seven, called The Group of Seven, Art for a Nation, Le Groupe des Sept, L'émergence d'un art national, was a massive, and I would argue, Art Gallery of Ontario, Vancouver's VAG, and Montreal's Musée des Beaux-Arts. And a splendidly illustrated catalogue, Raisonné, was published simultaneously in French and English. I call this exhibition strategic because of its political timing, its itinerary and venues, and its ideological underpinnings. Prominently displayed on the back dust jacket above a full-color reproduction of Lismer's Pine Tree and Rocks is this quotation from a controversial 1919 exhibition. The great purpose of landscape art is to make us at home in our own country. And the great implied purpose of this bilingual exhibition was to reinforce Canadian faith in our own country at a point in our history when the country seemed to be falling apart. The idea of North, I might just add here, has periodically served as a flag around which to rally in a shared, unified Northern identity and common national purpose. However, Art for a Nation was only one of a number of significant arts and cultural events of recent years to be specifically associated with the North. For at least the past 13 years, the Great Northern Arts Festival has been held in Inuvik. In 1998, Canada hosted the first Northern Encounters Festival, which brings the artists and arts of all, and there are 11, circumpolar countries together. From 1996 to 1998, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Klondike Gold Rush, which precipitated the publication of many books and CD-ROMs, television coverage, and an increase in tourism to the Yukon. My favorite Klondike centenary event was the publication of Robert Croce's novel, The Man from the Creeks. Its very title, drawn, as I'm sure some of you will recognize, from Robert Service's famous poem, The Shooting of Dan McGrew. And the image that is used on Robert's dust jacket is possibly the most famous image from that period of the miners climbing the Chilkoot Pass on their way to the gold fields. But Croce, for all his love of the North, is a Southern writer and knows it. What the specifically Northern arts continue to give us is enormous and different. From its small beginnings under James Houston in the 1950s, Inuit sculpture, graphics, and wall hangings have blossomed into a successful national and international art that brings the North to the South and returns benefits to the North. While it may be a bit premature to say just what the film Atanarjuat will do to our ideas of North, I know I have to mention it tonight. Atanarjuat, the fast runner, won its director, Zacharias Kunik, the camera d'or at the 2001 Cannes Festival for the best first feature film, and it has gone on to win more awards and much attention. If you missed it at last fall's Vancouver Film Festival, don't get alarmed. It is playing right now in theaters near you in downtown Vancouver, and I really recommend that you see it on the big screen. Repeatedly, this film is being described, as it is here by Cooper Langford, as carrying an Inuit view to a big world outside. But I'd suggest that it is doing much more. First, it is a spectacularly beautiful film that quotes and revises a host of earlier so-called Eskimo or God's Country movies from Nanook forward. I see Atanarjuat as a cinematic writing back to that earlier non-Inuit tradition. Second, it marks a fascinating conjunction of ancient narrative, of myth, with the latest technology. And by doing this, it celebrates human creativity. Third, it represents the Igloolik Inuit to themselves as a people living in time. Something Kunik values above all else. His toughest screening test was not in Cannes, but in Igloolik, his home, where Igloolik Izuma Productions is based, and where his community judges his achievements. Part four, going north right here. In conclusion, I want to stress the point that north is not only a geological or meteorological matter of tree lines, eskers, permafrost, snow, and temperatures that can dip as low as minus 81 Celsius. North, while it has certainly been naturalized as essential to Quebec in the Pays d'Anneau concept and to Canada as the true north, strong and free, is a human construct, like Canada itself. It has become part of what the French scholar Pierre Bourdieu calls the habitus, and we have learned to accept it as a given. The imagined idea of North has done and continues to do a great deal of ideological and practical work for this country. Moreover, it has accumulated a wide range of fascinating, contradictory associations, a set of familiar, compelling stories, a particular rhetoric and aesthetic, and a constellation of stubborn stereotypes and exclusions. North permeates all aspects of our culture, from painting to comic strips, from politics to classical music and epic fictions, like Mordecai Richler's Solomon Gursky Was Here, Gabriel Roy's classic novel La Montagne Secrète, or long poems like Canto's North by Henry Beisel, who tells us that North is where all parallels converge to open out into the mystery surrounding us. North surrounds us in tourist trinkets and advertisements for mutual funds and beer. Here's a good one from the 1995 rock concert in Nanuvik, sponsored by Molson's, and here's my favorite. Ideas of North permeated CBC's February 2nd, 2002 tribute to Peter Zoski, who cherished the North. They were on the very southern stage of UBC's Chan Center for the Performing Arts on March 14th, when we celebrated our creative research activities in the form of our own Borealis Quartet and in Richard Prince's sound sculpture installation, The Aurora, on all three channels. And then there's those pretty quirky ideas of North as the defining image of Canada and defining Canadian principle that entered our southern homes in magazines just a couple of weeks ago. By the way, that label in the lower corner telling us that it's not the same if it's not Canadian, get the genuine article, that's not stuck on, folks. It's part of, indeed, it's the marketing point of the image. If we are to understand how North has shaped, and I believe continues to shape and reshape Canada, then we must trace the idea of North in as many of its manifestations and formulations as possible. We must be alert to its shifts, modulations, and nuances, the degree to which, like the polar ice or magnetic North, it moves. We must keep drawing new maps, making new agreements, remembering where our power comes from. Canada cannot abandon ideas of North, but Canadians can understand them and learn to accept, perhaps even to welcome change in the ongoing story. If Frobisher Bay can become Iqaluit and Nunavut emerge from the Northwest Territories, formerly Rupert's Land, then anything can happen on a voyage north. I'd like to leave you with a closing thought, and I have to do this in English because I don't speak Inuktitut. These are the words of Eskimo Song by Orpingalik, originally recorded by Knud Rasmussen in the 1920s. They continue to be cited and recited by contemporary writers. Coming south from the north, Eskimo Song speaks to renewed ideas, new songs of North. Songs are thoughts which are sung out with the breath when people let themselves be moved by a great force and ordinary speech no longer suffices. A person is moved like an ice floe which drifts with the current. Our thoughts are driven by a flowing force when we feel joy, when we feel fear, when we feel sorrow. Thoughts can surge in on us, causing us to gasp for breath and making our hearts beat faster. And we will hesitate before using words, but it will happen that the words we need will come of themselves. When the words that we need shoot up of themselves, we have a new song. Thanks very much. Yes, please.
Do our northern people have community and communication with other
circumpolar peoples? I'll repeat the question because I know from experience that it can't always be heard. The question was, do people living in Canada's north have communication with other circumpolar northern communities and peoples? And the answer is yes. In many ways, and some of the activities, like the Arctic Winter Games that were held this year jointly between Iqaluit and in Greenland. I mean, this is just one very recent example of a lot of communication they're aware of. Yes, indeed.
Like the Sami of Finland, I mean the whole...
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes, yes. Yes. The question is, have I heard tapes from the early 1950s of the CBC broadcasting to the north? in French, English, and Inuktitut. I have. There are examples of these in the National Library of Canada, where I spent some time doing research, on very, including on Gould, because that's where Gould's papers and manuscripts are, looking at a number of collections, archival collections there, including audio tapes, yes. I have. And when Gould's Idea of North was done in 1967, it was done twice. It was done for CBC here, if you will, in southern Canada, and then it was done on CBC North. And as I mentioned in my remarks, he had a different introduction for the two broadcasts, and he was aware of the fact that he was speaking to very different people when the CBC North was broadcasting his composition. Yes, here at the front. A very good question, I think, was how can the concept of multiculturalism be reconciled with the idea of North? Well, my answer to that question would be that North typifies, exemplifies what is possible with Canadian multiculturalism. There are so many cultures across Canada's North, and I would include in that the northern parts of our provinces, the subarctic and the higher Arctic. One of the most moving experiences I had on a trip that my husband and I took to the western Arctic was on a ferry crossing the Mackenzie River, which was in itself kind of special thing to do. And a young man, 18, a young Dene man, was hooked into whatever you call those things, a Walkman. And he was listening to whatever hip-hop or whatever thing that young people listen to. And I got into conversation with him, and he told me how terribly unhappy and lonely he had been in Whitehorse because he was so far away and so isolated in Whitehorse. Well, he was from Arctic Red River. And and then he would speak in his own language to give orders to people or take orders or you know, communicate with people. And I was hearing around me all these different languages as I went from the Yukon across the Northwest Territories on that ferry and then up to Inuvik. So it seems to me that North really represents a lot of what I'm saying here is multiculturalism, in fact. Yes.
I would assume that the northern people are embracing the World Wide Web.
Fascinating question. The assumption is that northerners, people in Nunavut and Northwest Territories and the Yukon have embraced the World Wide Web. You got to believe it. They are on the web. They are surfing. They have websites. You can call them up. It's amazing. Yes. In a word, at least in some of the major centers, they are.
Are they dreading global warming?
I should repeat the question. Are they dreading, was it?
Yes.
Are they dreading global warming? Yes. I mean, over and over again, it is northerners who are telling us and have been telling us for a long time that significant changes are taking place and that global warming is coming and that is a danger and so forth. So, and in fact, I think I brought with me tonight a very recent thing that came in a magazine or something. The elders in the north are trying to alert the rest of Canada, southern Canada, to what they see as the dangers of global warming and the rapid advance of global warming. So I don't want to speak for them directly, but say that what I read about what they say and what I have access to here would suggest that they are very concerned and have been concerned for quite some time. Ron.
I wonder if there's a danger in the way you set this up, because in each case you've said that the North is up there, thinking in terms of the map as we conventionally see it, and you don't include us in the North down here along the South. And one of the things that strikes me, and it struck me often, John Ralston Saul has been talking, is that Canadians don't think of themselves as Northern. And because of this, they think of themselves as rich Americans living along the South and don't really educate themselves as a Northern nation.
Did everybody hear that question? Did you hear it at the back? I don't know what to answer to that, because I thought I was doing the exact opposite of that, Ron. I thought the whole burden of my lecture, and I must have failed dismally, was to drive home. If I could have turned the electricity out here and talked in the dark, I would have. Then I wouldn't have been able to do my PowerPoint. But the whole thrust of what I've been saying is that we are North. North is right here. I thought I said that over and over again. I mean, I don't know what to say in response to your comment. Of course we are, and indeed, what I was trying to say was that the sooner we wake up and recognize that, the sooner we'll be able to understand where we are and appreciate what we're a part of. Yes, at the front here. Sorry, I can't see you. Oh, a wonderful point, and that is that on the credits, the creator should be named before BC Hydro. Yes. Yes.
I am a little bit concerned about the future. In view of the demand for energy, in view of the expressed concerns in our southern neighbor, in view of the circumpolar support for preservation of northern circumstances, what do you project and consider that in 10, 15 years would be the future of the North?
The question was in view of environmental problems, a whole range of challenges and crises facing the planet. What do I see as the future of the North in over the next 15 years or so? I think that was the sort of gist of the question. I guess I'm very concerned, but I also think there's nothing to be gained by being pessimistic. That I think I probably am by nature fairly optimistic. I guess that's why I'm standing here tonight. I think that's why I spent as many years as I did doing the research on Canada and the idea of North, this new book. I also feel that I can't do anything. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a geographer. I'm not an engineer. I can't fix it. But maybe the will, which means the taxpayers' will, to commit to fixing some of the things we need to fix can be moved if the humanist, and that's what I can do, can get the message across that the North is a rich, fascinating, fragile, beautiful, crucial to us and to the world environment. So in my way, the best I can, and being an optimist, I have to believe that by speaking to you tonight and by doing what I can do, that we can make a difference. But the people who are actually going to fix it are the politicians, the scientists, the engineers, and we need, as the citizens of this country, to have the political will to support that work. I'm heartened, I must say, deeply heartened, by NSERC and SHRC's renewed commitment to research in the Arctic. I think that is a very important step. At the very back. Yes, at the very back. Yes?
Most of the views that we receive are from the perspective of those of us who live in the southern part of Canada, and it's reinforced only from a daily basis about North. How do Northerners feel about that, and how do they perceive that their view can be perhaps
I think you would have all heard the question. No, the question was how do Northerners view the South? So much of what we get is all the Southerners talking, and what do the how do the Northerners view these matters? View the South, or view themselves, or view these matters? Well, number one, I cannot pretend that I'm a Northerner. Although I've traveled in the Arctic, it's been very much as a wimp going in the warm weather in the summer, and my limited experience doesn't give me any authority to speak. If I read what they say, and I do, or listen to what they say, and try to work with the art and other cultural artifacts that they produce, then I'd have to say that they have a lot to say about themselves to each other, part of which means not giving much of a damn about whether we're listening or what we think, but at the same time caring a very great deal and attempting to communicate in a whole number of ways, while at the same time being themselves with each other. And certainly, I think there's been a great, again, I can't homogenize it. It's not all one. These people are all very different across this huge country. And when you look at the Cree, the anger of the Cree over James Bay, and the, you know, the distress caused in the last little while with this new agreement, the so-called La Paix des Braves, this is what the Innu are claiming. The Innu right now are trying to do arrange a meet some kind of agreement, make a deal with the federal government. And in the news, I think it was just today or last night, they're being given a rather hard time. And I think the phrase was the federal government's playing hardball. Governments have played hardball with the Innu throughout the 20th century. Churchill Falls is another example. Military test flights is another example. To say that there isn't passionate anger, resentment, bitterness, fury, rage, protest is to close our eyes. But there are different kinds of responses across the North, depending. Some of the things that have been written and published are very, very moving on this matter. I would say that the film Atanarjuat obliquely addresses some of these situations by not addressing them, in a sense, which is what I find interesting. But I would like to suggest, my colleagues and family are going to recognize this one, but I would like to suggest that you read this book if you haven't read this one. It's Thompson Highway's, or you have, Thompson Highway's Kiss of the Fur Queen. Says it all. Thompson Highway, the playwright, Kiss of the Fur Queen. Yes.
I lived most of my life in the North.
Ah. Uh-huh.
From my experience, I feel that the Northern Europe, we're far more than in the South, are more connected to the North, and the Northerners are connected to the South. They really have very little connection to the South at all. They're really in love with the North.
Than the other way around. a wonderful comment. I don't know how I can summarize it, but I'll try. That this woman has lived and taught in the north, in the Arctic and Eastern Arctic and Baffin Island, mentioned in particular teaching adults art in Pond Inlet, and her sense being that not only are Southerners more fascinated or interested in the north and know more about the north than Northerners know about the south, but again, you commented from personal experience that many Inuits living on Baffin Island, for example, are very cheery about the idea, very, very uncertain about the idea of coming south at all, and are not necessarily very intrigued or interested or curious about the south at all. And I think that is a really very, very interesting observation from firsthand experience of years of living in the north and working in the north. In my brief experiences on Baffin Island, and that small example of that young Dene chap on the ferry who hated Whitehorse because it was too big and alienating, is again, you know, that's hardly south, as far south as we are, but for him it was south and it was awful. And I remember on Baffin Island talking to Inuit people in English because I don't have an Inuktitut, and hearing a little of their very careful to be courteous comments. One was that they hated being in the south. They found the trees terrifying, awful, horrible. And I also wonder to what extent either firsthand experiences or stories about family experiences of being brought out of the north into the south for a treatment of tuberculosis or goodness knows what have created a scar in the imagination or actually literally in Northerners' minds and Northerners' histories. I would have thought that might perhaps also play a role, but I was struck by the comment, something I not only take for granted but adore, you know, with our trees, how horrible trees were. And of course the Arctic is beautiful, but it's on a miniature scale, even orchids on a miniature scale. Yes, at the top.
You use the term high Arctic. Is that the area beyond where people live or where the presumable land?
I told John he couldn't ask questions tonight, but he might be able to answer that, John. The question was, how precisely would you define, and I think this really is a geographer's question, John I'm referring to is Dr. John Steiger. Dr. Steiger can answer that question more precisely and scientifically than I can. What do we mean by the high Arctic? Not just where people aren't living, but where there's not land anymore, where there's gravel. It's really desert, I would say, much of the high Arctic. But John, can you kick in something there for us? Here we go. Dr. Steiger. He referred to the geographer Louis-Edmond Amelin and his Nordicity Index or Indices. I have actually had Amelin's permission to reproduce that in my book, so that whole chart with all of those indices, I forget now how many, but there are 14 or 15 of them, are actually there. Yeah. Lovely question. Oh, again, I can't see you behind this thing.
Could you
This is a hard question. Do Northerners want development? And if they do, what kind of development and what do they want from us? The only people who would dare to answer that question would be the Northerners themselves, but I will venture this much on their behalf, that if they do want development, it has to be on their terms. Wonderful questions. And I think that's enough questions, is it? Thank you very, very much.
I invite Richard Cavell now to come forward and thank our speaker. Richard?
As Cheryl Grace has indicated to us tonight, the Canadian North is uncanny. It is both there and here. It's in the North, but also in many ways in the South. It is a very familiar place and utterly unfamiliar. As Cheryl has so powerfully demonstrated in this evening's lecture, the North is also present in multiple aspects of Canadian culture, in art, music, film, popular culture. At the same time, the North is part of Canada that few will ever see and even fewer ever know. Cheryl Grace knows the North through the unique range and depth of the interdisciplinary scholarship she has brought to this topic, as well as through her critical insistence that the North is an idea, not an essence, in history and not only a myth. Cheryl, it's been wonderful to follow you into the North this evening. Please join me in thanking her again.
Thank you, everybody, for a wonderful year. This is the final lecture. It's kind of sad in a way to not have these Saturday evenings, but thank you all for supporting us, joining and being members. It's a great institution. We'll reconvene in September for the 86th year of the Vancouver Institute. Thank you again. Have a safe journey home.